But right now I'm talking to David Tait, who's chairman of the Shoreham Society and has also put together a book called Memories of Shoreham. David, hello, welcome and happy Christmas.
Hello, Tony. Happy Christmas, too.
Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
You've done this... Oh, well, it's very difficult, isn't it? You've done this as an oral history. Just for people who aren't aware, just define for us what that process is, would you?
Well, the idea is to capture the living memories of people about a town or a district or a village or whatever, going back as far as they can, and particularly talking to people who can remember the place when it was very different to as we know it now, when so many of the things we take for granted were either innovations or luxuries or hadn't even been invented. And a lot of these people, of course, will no longer be with us in a few years' time. And we wanted to capture their memories so that it wasn't just a historian talking about facts, but people who had lived through these times and remembered it from a personal viewpoint.
That's interesting, actually. It's one of those responsibilities, isn't it, that if we're to look after the heritage, you do have to capture people before it's too late. You have the means electronically to capture their actual voice now, rather than just writing things down, but of course you can't do it after they've died.
Well, that's right, and they're talking about the sort of minutiae of social history, which professional historians, and we won't say they're not interested in, but they haven't got time to record.
But it's that that makes history live, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's
the price of a bottle of milk, or what happened every Sunday afternoon when the pictures were closed. Those are the things that make us people alive now think, golly, how different it was then, or how much the same it was then.
Yes, either of those two reactions are equally likely.
All right, so how do you find, and where do you find the people from whom you've established this oral history, the memories of Shoreham? Where did you look for people?
Well, we have a lively society, the Shoreham Society, over some 600 members, and we have a newsletter, and we have very good contact with the local press. And so one way or the other, we publicised the fact that we wanted to start this project, and we knew a lot of people personally who had taken an interest in the town. Many of them had lived there all their lives. Others, like many members of our society, had been incomers, but who had taken up an interest in the society, helped with the local museum. So we had plenty of opportunities to let people know what we had in mind, and gradually we got to hear of people, or people would recommend, they'd say, well, you ought to talk to old Mrs. So-and-so, she's lived here all her life, and I'm sure she's got something interesting to tell you. So one way or the other, over a period of 3 years, I mean, it wasn't 3 years continually, but picking up leads here and there, we amassed sufficient material to choose what we thought was the... not necessarily the most interesting or the best, but the widest range possible.
Yeah, sure. I bet you ended up with an awful lot of cassettes.
We did. They weren't all based on interviews. Some of them were pieces that people had actually sat down and written for us, which, of course, saved a lot of our time, because the laborious part was listening to the cassettes, transcribing them, and ending up on various word processors, because this cut down the production costs if we just handed over the discs to typesetters. So the mechanics of it were quite involved. And as you mentioned earlier, we did take advantage of modern technology within our particular rather limited means at our disposal, and got the thing together in a way that would probably have taken much longer had we not had these techniques.
And as you say, cost rather a lot more, because it's the Shoreham Society that's actually published this, and obviously cost was quite important. You just can't go out and sploosh money around as if there were no tomorrow.
No, indeed not, but I'm pleased to say that already we've sold more than three quarters of the original print run of 1,000 copies.
Oh, excellent.
And we're thinking now of a reprint.
Oh, that's jolly good. Many congratulations.
Well, thank you. We've covered the initial printing costs, and now we're making a little bit of profit, which will go mostly towards the Marlepins Museum and the Society's funds, and any other publishing projects that will come along.
Oh, yeah. Once you start these things, you know, you very rarely stop them.
Well, this is true, and the fact the existence of the book has led us to a lot more people who said, you know, well, I've got a little story you might be interested in. So volume two is now possible, but not yet a while.
And we're going to hear, we're actually going to listen to some of those pieces of what we call actuality, people talking about
yes.
Shoreham by Sea in a little while. But before then, I'd just like to quote some, in fact, a few facts too important to pass over. And this is quoted in the book here. I really like this. It's from 1934, so
yes,
we're talking about 60 years ago. Population 1934, estimated at 10,000. Rateable value, £80,500. 56 miles from London, 6 from Brighton, 5 from Worthing. Early closing day, Wednesday. Price of electricity, 7 pence halfpenny. That's old LSD money, of course, per unit, lighting, preferential rates for large consumers, domestic tariff for private houses, only 1 penny per unit, plus a fixed charge, price of gas, 9 pence per therm, water, excellent constant service supply from deep downland springs, rates for the year, 9 and 6 pence in the pound, altitude rising from sea level, by definition, to 350 feet. The death rate for Shoreham by Sea for 1933 was 11.6 per 1,000, whereas for England and Wales it was 12.3 per 1,000, thus proving incontrovertibly, David, that living in Shoreham was good for you.
Absolutely. And let's perhaps repeat that. Well, 1934. Some things haven't changed. It's still 56 miles from London and 5 from Worthing.
Mm.
But one or two other things have gone up a little bit.
Where did those facts actually come from?
Well, we wanted some little illustrations and snippets to fill out the gaps of, or not gaps, the text in the book to make it visually look a little more interesting. And that was from a guidebook that one of our members had in his personal collection, and we thought that snippet was worth including.
Absolutely. I mean, I think things like that just do make the place come alive much more easily than some other things. I mean, it's a statistic that applies to stuff we all consume, that's to say electricity and gas and water and so on, and we can all relate to it. I'd like to go back and talk about people's memories, particularly talking about the cinema. There's because I'm interested in films, and we do quite a lot of film stuff on our Saturday programme.
Uh-huh.
And in an interview that you've got with Bert and Peg Taylor, talking to John and Daphne Grover about life in Shoreham before the war, Bert says, well, cinemas, there were three when I was young. There was the Duke of York's, where Suitors were, the Star or the Court, as it was known in Church Street, where the Co-op storage is.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was the Coliseum, where the Civic Centre is now. It's an area of our life that has changed, and possibly not for the better. There just isn't as much in terms of cinema around anymore.
No. And that's particularly sad for Shoreham, when next year we'll be celebrating the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the film industry in this country. And, of course, Shoreham and Shoreham Beach was one of the very earliest studios in the whole country.
Now, I'd in fact know this from the last couple of weeks, but it's only in the last couple of weeks that I've learned that. The South Coast, and as you say, Shoreham in particular, has a vital role in the development of the British film industry.
That's right. And Shoreham, together with Hove, were centres which were used right up through to the 20s until the talkies came in. And the cinemas, of course, that Bert Taylor was talking about were mostly from the 20s through to a long time, sometime after the war.
Yeah, that would be the golden age, wouldn't it?
There was a piece too in Bert's interview which is rather delightful. He describes how he had to do so many sort of odd jobs in this cinema, and one of them was taking the posters out and doing fly posting right up as far as Beeding and Bramber and Stenning.
Oh, yes.
And there was one occasion, he recalls, when he got rather fed up and he threw a lot of these posters in the hedge, and thinking nobody would know that he hadn't actually bothered to put them up.
Mm.
But the next day, some kind person came into the cinema and said, look, I found all these posters in a hedge. Somebody must have dropped them. And he really...
Well, that was a flea in the ear for Bert.
Yes, I mean, he kept his job there.
It's quite interesting talking about jobs there, David, because I noticed in Bert's story and in lots of others that people did used to beetle from one job to another.
Yes, that struck me when I first heard that tape, which one of my colleagues did. And it shows that the work was there.
Mm.
And, of course, a lot of it was unskilled and manual work that Bert didn't have any particular training for, but he was able to leave his job in the cinema and go and work for a butcher's and then something else totally different in the garage.
Mm.
And it didn't bother him at all.
No, he said, it was Peggy starts this, she's talking about going to work. At 14, I went to work at DuBarry's, the perfumers
right.
in Hove.
Yes.
Interesting work, you know, labelling bath cubes and talcum powder and wrapping soap. But you had a timesheet and they gave you a certain time to do a join, but you could never do it in that time. You used to get into trouble at the end of the week because you hadn't done it in the time. It was terrible, more like school than work. Here's the bit I liked. Everyone on the train knew where we worked because of the smell, but we didn't get any free samples. And she says the wages, looking back here before the war, 10 and 6 a week, and the train fare was 4.5p a day.
Mm.
I gave all the money to my parents, and they gave me a shilling back for pocket money. Do you think those were the days?
They probably weren't. I suppose it's all relative, and if she thought a shilling was enough for her immediate needs, well, perhaps she was happy with it. But we really can't conceive of that sort of limitations financially these days.
No, but it's interesting that you've taken this historical snapshot and you've actually provided there a picture, as I say, a snapshot of how things were, and that's now pinned down. You don't lose that now because it's there in print, on tape, and the rest of it.
And this is somebody who experienced those times.
That's
just
right.
Somebody writing about it from a sort of abstracted point of view.
As you say, this isn't just history. I was there. That's what I always say about it. Mm. Now, obviously, Shoreham by Sea is special in that it's a coastal town, and I gather when you were talking to a gentleman called Arthur Godfrey that in a launching activity, launching a sailing boat, things didn't go exactly as they'd wanted them to.
That's right. On Shoreham Beach, there were several small boat yards, and of course Shoreham had a great history of boat building on the mainland part, as it were, as well. Certainly in the days of wooden ships and sail, but there were still several boat yards there right up to the 1950s, and on the beach itself there were boat yards and specialist boat builders, and this was a case where they had completed work on a 3-ton sailing ship, and it had been put in position on a slipway ready to be launched. And it was being launched by Dolly Arliss, who was the wife of George Arliss, a well-known actor and film star of his day. We're talking about the 20s and 30s, when, of course, many famous film stars and stage folk lived on Shoreham Beach. And they experienced a lot of difficulty getting this ship launched, as you'll hear from Arthur Godfrey's description.
Dolly came down and we got blocks from the yard. They're big blocks, big square blocks of wood, and we put these up in front of this boat, which was still on the bomb trailer, and we lifted Dolly up onto the top of these blocks, and we got a bottle of champagne on the bow end of this thing, and we told her, she named the boat Rattlesnake, and dropped this thing, and it didn't break, and away went the boat. We had to stop it. We pulled it back in. And we got her back up on the blocks again and pulled this bottle out and gave it to her. The next time she threw herself at it and she fell off the blocks, but she smashed this. And the boat, it must have had a charmed beginning, I think, as well as a charmed life, because it's still with us. The boat, before it actually hit the water and floated, the cradle broke on it and the boat went over on its side. It dropped about 3 feet. Flat down, and we thought, oh God, and it slewed out and it came up floating in this ripple of water, sitting there. It was magnificent, actually.
Goodbye, Dolly. We must leave you there, I think, a bit, wasn't it?
It absolutely is.
A story from Arthur Godfrey. Obviously, that really brings history alive off the page. It makes it come off the page. Have you got any plans to make cassettes available?
Well, we did think we might. Mm. It's really a question of recording quality, because they were never recorded with a view to listening or certainly broadcasting, although using techniques available here, we've improved what we've been listening or will hear in this program. But yes, it's still something that may well be possible. It's a question of editing, putting them together, and we could certainly probably produce a collected version of the actual folk speaking, and it's something we may do towards the funds of Marlepin's Museum, where we have a little shop.
It does sound a good idea for the future, perhaps. Now, one of the things that everybody, when you're talking about remembering, people who don't know Shoreham particularly well, or don't know Shoreham at all, possibly, living in the Southern Counties area, you need those hooks, those tags, things that we can all relate to, and one of them must undoubtedly be what it was like when you were growing up, when you first went to school. Looking at Reg Upton's memories, for example, he says, at the age of 3 years, I started school. I was taken by my older brother John to Hamroad School for boys and girls of all ages from the Shoreham area. The headmaster for the boys was a Mr. Oswald Ball, and the girls' headmistress was a Miss Barford. And it's funny, we can all remember those first days at the age of whatever it was, 3, 4, 5 years old. And even if you don't know the particular specific place terribly well, as I say, you can still relate to it, because school is an experience we all have in common. And I gather you've got a contributor called Dennis Bird talking about his school days.
Yes. He was talking about school days during the war particularly, and he was at Shoreham Grammar School, which is no longer there on its original site. In fact, it moved to more towards the Southwick end, and then became Shoreham College. But during the war, it was Shoreham Grammar School, and the boys had to share the school with the fire brigade. And here is Dennis Bird talking about those days, and how they had to go down to the shelters excavated in the playground.
They were in the... well, of course, one has to remember how it's changed now. The buildings of the school have all vanished now, and they are where the community centre was. Right. But the area within the stone walls was our playground, and the shelters were built there. They were semi-underground. There were great humps. I remember two long lines of humped-up earth and semi-underground. I suppose was about 5 or 6 feet down, with a reinforced top, and these two long shelters that we filed into. The buildings were shared with the fire brigade. Half the school was taken over. The headmaster's house, for instance, was no longer a house, and some of the classrooms were demolished. Well, not demolished, they were converted into garages, and so we had fire engines on the south side of the near the building called, it's still called Northover, I think, or Southover. So that side of it was the fire brigade. And then we had the classrooms on the northern side of the building. So it was all rather rather different from Shoreham College as it is now. The main part of the school, the boarding school, moved at the outbreak of war to Liphook, and their headmaster, Mr. Kirkman, went with them, so I really hardly knew him. And we, the day boys, were a separate school for 6 years. And we had a succession of teachers. Of course, the forces called up, the young teachers, of course, all joined the forces. We did have one chap, I remember him coming to teach us for a while in RAF uniform. He was being invalided out, Mr. Pascoe. But the others that we had were mostly older men, and they kept changing too, so it was all a little disturbed.
Did you find the activities of the fire brigade disruptive at all?
Not really, because when I say the shelters were in our playground, we, in addition to that, of course, we did have large grass playing fields up Connaught Avenue, which is now where the
Green
big
Acres
estate... Acres estate, which was the old Shoreham Grammar School playing fields. So the fire engines didn't stop the playing of games or anything like that. But they did mean that we only had half the playground when we had our break in mornings and afternoons. You know, we only had half the area to play in. But, no, we all rubbed along quite well together.
And indeed, everybody did. That's Dennis Bird there talking about his school days during the war, taken from Memories of Shoreham, an oral history project put together by the Shoreham Society. And I'm talking to David Tate, who's the chairman of the Shoreham Society. These are fascinating stories, David. And one of the things that I found particularly interesting was to do with a chap called Jack Lucking and his memories of a family business. Lucking's menswear shop in East Street in Shoreham, founded in 1908. And he says one of the most interesting things is about the way reps, or travellers, as they used to be called, behaved in the 20s.
Yes, I found that interesting when I spoke to Mr. Lucking, how they didn't have executive cars or the sort of trappings that we take for granted for these gentlemen now. They arrived at the station with their wicker baskets and they had to get round as best they could.
So they would actually make an arrangement, send out a wire or a letter on, and a carrier would meet them with presumably a pony and trap, or horse and cart of some sort.
Presumably, yes.
And then you chuck this thing on like a big laundry basket and take it to the clothing emporium, show your wares, and then presumably once you'd done that and been through the stuff, you would load the things back in the skip. It would then go back onto the trap onto the next shop, while you, the traveller, tried to get the shopkeeper to sign on the dotted line for however many of whatever it was he wanted, and then you'd walk round to the next shop and do the same thing again.
Absolutely, they certainly must have earned their commission in those days.
It's odd, isn't it? As you say now, hundreds of thousands or millions of these guys just jump into their Mondeos and hurtle up and down the motorways. It was that's one of the ways that our society is very, very different, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And the practical side of that, I mean, the cars were available, and it is thought that the costings of it would have made them much more efficient, and their employers could have invested in some sort of motor transport for them, but clearly that wasn't the case.
Well, certainly not with all of them. Presumably this was a gradual process whereby people in the bigger companies, or perhaps the more successful travellers, would have cars quicker than anybody else.
Yes. Well, whether they did what they called cold calling and sort of waited till a customer got out of the shop before they dragged in their wicker basket and hoped for an interview.
It paints an interesting picture, doesn't it? It does paint an interesting picture. Yes. The shops and stores of Shoreham, again, make interesting reading. Eads Stores was one of the most famous.
Yes, they had, I think, four branches altogether, including one on the beach. And they disappeared, I think, through competition from some of the bigger chains when they began to get established. And there was also an unfortunate situation that developed, I think, in the late 50s, early 60s, when there was a tremendous amount of planning blight because a relief road was planned through Shoreham, and Eads Stores was in the way of this, and the traders all started packing up, boarding up their premises, because they knew that they would probably have to get out sooner or later, and that was how the last branch of Eads Stores came to close.
Yes, a great pity, and descendants of the original store owners speak with considerable regret about how, under compulsory purchase, they got something like £25 or something for the shop. It's just absolutely disgraceful the way things like that happened at that period. Obviously, one of the things that that people listening will be really interested in is the effect of the war and wartime on Shoreham and the people of Shoreham. I was reading the memories of a lady called Mary Maple.
Oh, yes.
Talking about Southends and elsewhere, and how they got the attentions, if that's the right word, of bombers. V1, of course, coming over, and bombers on the return trip to Germany from having bombed London would come and just get rid of anything they hadn't dropped over London and just kind of casually jettison quite a lot of bombs off, and you'd hear the siren, and then, of course, because you weren't so accustomed to the idea of an air raid, it would be air raids every night. It would be much more of a surprise, presumably.
Well, that's right. I don't believe Shoreham, in spite of being a port, was ever specifically targeted, and it was in the way you mentioned, offloading bombs and stuff they wanted to get rid of, that where the town did suffer from time to time.
Now, in its development, the town grew up partly, at least, because it was quite trendy among the rather raffish entertainment end of the spectrum, wasn't it? People in entertainment and show business actually quite liked Shoreham.
Oh yes, it was particularly Bungalow Town, and there's a delightful book that's now out of print by Neb Walters called Bungalow Town, and he has some delightful stories of the film colony and the showbiz people who lived more or less exclusively on Shoreham Beach. I can't think of any who lived in the main part of the town, but it was still part of Shoreham.
And you've got some recollections from Reggie Leggett.
Oh, yes.
About the way Bungalow Town grew up.
Yes. Reggie Leggett is a very much a respected senior citizen of Shoreham. He's a gentleman in his 88th year. And he, incidentally, did a tremendous amount, more or less single-handed, to avert some of the awful things that were planned in the 60s to modernise, in quotes, the town.
Yes.
And the case we mentioned earlier of all these shops that were going to be bulldozed, it was partly through Reggie Leggett's efforts in averting this that that was saved. But in the piece we're going to hear, he talks about his earliest memories as a little lad on Shoreham Beach, where they had very primitive conditions in their little wooden bungalows, which nevertheless had a tremendous atmosphere to them, or one could imagine from what the stories that other people have told. And here he is describing some of his earliest memories of life on the beach.
In those days, apart from there being no proper roads, we had no main water in our early days on Shoreham Beach. There wasn't such a thing as main water. Ead's stores used to deliver drinking water, which they sold by the gallon to people. As I say, it shows how primitive the conditions must have been in those early days when I lived there.
Yes.
And there was no... there was no sanitation at all, other than cesspits that people had, or septic tanks.
Yes.
And a pretty primitive bucket arrangement that everybody had, including us, in those early days, where there was a man called the sanitary man used to come around every night. It was... the conditions were pretty grim in those days, those sort of conditions were.
Yes.
And the winters were pretty hard, because Shoreham Beach was very much exposed, and all the bungalows in those days were timber built and pretty drafty, most of them. But in those very early days there was no gas. We had no gas at all. There wasn't such a thing as gas on Shoreham Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody used to cook by oil stoves or coal fires, the kitchen ranges, we had one.
Yes.
But gas never came for many, many years. And that was followed by electricity. But I say we lived through some very primitive times in our early days.
Yes.
I suppose some people in those early days did have a telephone on, but we didn't. And we, believe me, when the summers went, when the winters came, we felt pretty isolated over there.
Yes,
and it was isolated. And darn cold, too.
I bet it was darn cold. Timber-built buildings without any electricity or gas, David.
Mm. One or two of those did survive the clearance in the early part of the war, when General Montgomery himself, who was the head of OC Southern Command, decreed that the whole lot should be blown up. But some did survive, as I say, and are there as... relics of that era.
Yes, and conditions that we wouldn't particularly many of us care to try today.
No.
Water sold by the gallon. I mean, that's extraordinary. It is an extremely interesting picture of a town as it was. I congratulate you on what must be a tremendous amount of effort that's gone into it. It must have taken people over those 3 years hours and hours and hours.
No, it did. We thoroughly enjoyed it. It was it did have its onerous elements, but as I say, we enjoyed doing it, and we met a lot of people that we wouldn't have met in the course of it, and it was a great privilege to talk to them.
So there you are. That's Memories of Shoreham, with the foreword by Dr. Peter Brandon, and it's published by the Shoreham Society. David Tait, thank you very much indeed for joining us, especially on Christmas Day. Enjoy the rest of your day.